Hi, this is James French.
This is Ted Diamond.
And you're listening and watching the Awareness Connection, a podcast where we talk about health and human development, mind-body awareness. And today we're going to be talking about what that has to do with education. This is a big topic. We've addressed, in broad strokes, education before on this podcast, specifically when we talked about consciousness, maybe higher learning, you know, maybe higher personal achievement and attainment when it came to mental practice. But Ted, I know that you've been pondering the question of this subject, F.M. Alexander's work as well. How does this apply to bringing up kids? How does this apply to educating children? It doesn't seem to have an obvious answer. I know this is something that you've been pondering for a long time. Alexander himself pondered it, tried a few things. And I'm very interested in what you have to say about this. Some people in my family are teachers, they're educators, they're school administrators. And I don't have a clear answer on this. I'm of course not a childhood educator, but I think that this is a fascinating topic to look at, and it's important.
Yeah. Well, the most obvious thing is that we don't take into account children's, you could say posture, but also motor learning in general, as we don't take it seriously as an aspect of child development.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
That's the most obvious part, because we have concepts of emotional development. We have concepts of cognitive development. We do not, but we don't have concepts of motor development as an educational, kind of field. Obviously, we have concepts of motor development as part of our understanding of infant development,
sure,
biology,
yeah.
But we don't have a concept of it in education. So really, kids, how they develop at the motor level is ignored, except when there's something wrong. If there's something wrong, then we have remedial care, we have occupational therapy, we have physical therapy, you know, aspects, we have neurological assessments, et cetera. But we don't look at a child that's typically, the typically developing child, and say, well, in the same way that I'm looking at their emotional development or their cognitive development, am I looking at their motor development?
Right, right. And I know that this is something that you've compared the sort of attention we pay to childhood motor development now. You've compared it to the sort of attention that was paid to childhood emotional development, say in like the European and American 19th centuries, where it was just sort of like, I don't know, you know, there's no real theories of development. There's no theories of stages about, okay, what can we expect a child to go through at such and such age, and how can we help it along? What might go wrong? It was a sort of like a, I mean, it wasn't just inadequate. It was almost insultingly inadequate. It was like it was just not present.
You're thinking of like if children had in the 18 or 1900s, when children had emotional difficulties, you said they were, you know, malingering, or they were lazy, or they needed more discipline. So yeah, in that sense, we had no developed concept of emotional development. We wouldn't have recognized, let's say, depression or other emotional issues that we today have much more developed idea.
Yeah. And so there was no subject. I mean, it like wasn't seen as something to be studied and understood and have insights about.
No.
You know, this is the sort of claim that you're making about childhood motor development. And
well,
it's
in one way. I mean, in another way, we obviously have concepts of motor development. I mean, you know, we recognize stages of.
Sure. Yeah. You know. Yeah. Yeah. Just to get clear on the claims that you're making here.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, we don't look at it as we don't look at a 6-year-old in the classroom and say, well, you know, what goes into motor function behavior? Do they have a proper command of the motor system? You know, we pretty much relegate that to physical, you know, exercise.
Yeah.
And, you know, and we have those sort of crude divisions that go way back to the Greeks, you know, where you have gymnasium is sort of sports, and you have learning, and they're kind of separated. And that's a pretty crude, undeveloped idea.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, you know, what we see often, and this is maybe an outcome of some of those crude divisions, but it's also, you know, you see people maybe having a more enlightened view of what children need. And so they're still doing things like, and, you know, I don't want to denigrate anything, but, you know, putting yoga practice in classrooms, or like, you know, exercise classes, stretching classes. And I don't know, what do you say about that?
Yeah. Very often, I mean, because we've accepted yoga as sort of a discipline that has value, has, you know, has health benefits, other benefits, we assume that expertise in yoga qualifies you to work with children, but it really doesn't. I mean, any more than, I don't know, having expertise in vocal study means that I could teach 4-year-olds how to sing. It's not clear that just because I know something about singing that I should be applying that to a 4-year-old.
Right.
A lot of these disciplines need to be thought out so that they're age appropriate. Mm-hmm. And in general, I would say yoga is not age appropriate for kids who are 3 and 4. And
right.
Now there are people who would challenge that and say that's a bias, but good, they should challenge it.
Sure.
And I have no problem saying it because, you know, because if you actually look at what kids are doing at 3 and 4, they're barely able to handle that. They're barely able to handle ballet at 3 and 4 either. I'm not a big fan of that either.
Mm-hmm.
But the bigger question is what claims would I make? You know, we'll
right.
talk a little
yeah.
bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I know, like, you know, the claim that, you know, yoga is not age appropriate, or, you know, kids can barely handle ballet at 3 or 4. Often you make the case that kids can barely handle a pen and paper at age 3 and 4. And this is an actual real thing that we have to grapple with when we're educating children. Like, what is their motor development? What is age appropriate? How and how do you tackle this?
Yeah.
You know? What does a more enlightened conception of childhood motor development entail?
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that in general, we don't have a concept of motor development because the science of infant, or the sort of biology of infant development, doesn't really include the kind of study of motor function that's needed. So a child typically developing child is going to go through certain stages where typically they're going to be, you know, walking by 1 year, 12 months or so. They're not going to be really fully capable of upright activities till they're 2 or 3, and the spine is developing. And then, you know, and we have a pretty good idea. I think intuitively our idea of when kids should begin school is actually pretty good. We don't really expect kids to be doing formal learning till they're 5 or 6. I think that's pretty good because they should be just playing and moving. And that obviously that involves cognitive activity, but it's sort of dominated by play, and it should be.
Yeah.
But just because you've outlined those stages doesn't mean you understand fully why this is a field, because, you know, what goes wrong with those stages? How does a child develop motor system? Are there aspects of it that the child needs to consciously pay attention to? I think what F. Matthias Alexander brought to that equation is that he saw that there is an actual postural system that organizes motor function.
Yeah,
he called that the primary control.
Mm-hmm.
And you wouldn't even know there was a primary control if it wasn't for the fact that you look at the thing working wrong in adults. So a little bit like you mentioned with emotional development, how would you know that there is even such a thing as emotional health unless you had a concept of ill health?
Yeah.
That makes you look at it and identify it as an actual thing. And I think that, you know, we'd have to credit Freud as being one of the people, and that whole era of Freudian, of sort of deeper psychology, where people began to see that there was such a thing as emotional pathology, and therefore there's such a thing as emotional health and growth.
Right. Right,
and I think that the discovery of the primary control is sort of the equivalent of that in the motor field.
Yeah, interesting. And you know, F. Matthias Alexander, of course, made a study of his own vocal malfunction, found out sort of what was wrong, and it was, like you said, at least part of it was the fact that this postural mechanism was distorted, and it need to be, in his case, returned to function. And so it's like, you know, how, it, you know, with Freud, it was a real, study of pathology, and then his claims about health were the sort of absence of pathology. Like, the mere absence of pathology. And I think that he was, I don't know whether the right word is cynical or not. It was just sort of like, okay, like, now that you have a lack of pathology, now you can just have normal human unhappiness. You know, like, okay, like, it was a sort of like, he was more interested in pathology than he was in whatever person lacked pathology, because it's not really all that interesting. Yeah. It's just every day. It's ugly. And somehow I think that Alexander's conception of health was more maybe it was more English or something like this. Maybe it was more Australian even. But his conception of health, his conception of restoration was. I think more optimistic and interesting.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, and I think Freud's idea was sort of a romantic conception. So it, you know, he instinctively treated. He sort of thought civilization can only make us less happy, and we were sort of happier in a more primitive state, and
a romantic
conception. And Alexander did not have a romantic conception. He was very much like forward looking.
Right. Right.
But I think this postural system, which you could say from the point of view of motor development, corresponds to a very basic stage in motor skill or motor development where tone, you have to have underlying muscle tone or tonic activity as a foundation for all subsequent phases. That's Alexander found what I think is an organizing principle for posture. But the Alexander technique, or Alexander's work as it's taught today, focuses almost entirely on that and managing that. And there's actually a much deeper part of it that goes way beyond posture, because if posture is the foundation for motor function, then you have to add to posture behavioral activity that posture makes possible or creates the foundation for. So Alexander's work, understood properly, includes posture as a foundation for motor skill, and then motor activity itself that is now misdirected because the postural system we can't rely on it to work properly as we get older. Mm. And then another piece of it that I add to that equation would be attention, because when you perform actions based on posture, so you have posture and motor actions, you also have an attention level that's involved that often becomes distorted. So now you have a much broader psychophysical activity, or what I'd call psychophysical, because we're no longer talking about something just purely physiological here.
Sure.
You have posture, motor activity, and attention level. And okay. Those elements now are what I'd say, you know, make up a more of a complete foundation for the motor aspect of a child's development that has been left out of normal education.
Okay.
I would say we don't have a positive concept of that aspect of a child's development. And it gets even broader than that, but you know, I just want to say that part of it.
Yeah. So just to restate, it's sort of a tripart subject that you're talking about here. There's what you might call a physical aspect, which is this postural mechanism. It has to do with muscle tone. It has to do with coordinated muscle and bone activity, et cetera. And that's sort of an organizing, you know, like a physically organizing principle for how we do things, you know? And then the second part is the doing of things. It's it's action, it's motor activity that's beyond the simply postural. It's you know, the work of daily life, you know, getting up, walking around, going to the bathroom, eating, etc., and all of the other things that we do. And the fact that as we get older, as a child develops into a mature adult, their very actions tend to put the first part wrong. It tends to be harmful to the first part. So it's like, okay, so there's an educational aspect to here as well. So not only are you learning about the first part, you're sort of coming to appreciate the second part and learning about it. And then the third part that you would add is the first two have to do with attention. There's something about attention that depends on the first two, and the function of attention. Is this right? Like sort of.
Well, yeah, I would say the attention, how it depends on them is one thing. Attention is just part of motor acts is being attentive in your environment.
Okay. Yeah.
So if you look at an infant crawling, there's posture. Their ability for an infant just to simply be on all fours depends on postural activity. Mm-hmm. The action when they see something and move toward it, that's why we have postures, in order to perform a motor act. So you have posture, you have motor acts, and the act of seeing the thing and wanting to move toward it is an act of attention. So now we see that even a motor act, even saying that there's a motor act, doesn't do justice to the psychophysical complexity of moving toward the thing, because it's also the act of seeing it, identifying it, and wanting to move toward it. Mm. So even in a seven month old infant, you have a very complex psychophysical activity. So you really can't look at posture alone. And if you do, yeah. you're just simply, you know, it's just kind of naive because, and in fact, the Alexander technique, if you teach it as posture, it's naive because the truth is that they're coming in with whatever problem they have due to motor activities, not because they have harmful posture.
Right. Yeah.
Anyway, so that, yeah. So the attention is just part of performing a motor act and a really subtle, complex part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But now you've got a concept of development and a concept of function that's not just sort of by, oh, I've got to take care of my body. You know, I'm reading to my child and, he's learning in the classroom and, and his cognitive development seems okay and everything's fine on that end. So, but I also want him to do some exercises or be active. Well, that's not enough.
Mm-hmm.
Being active, of course, is important. But here we're talking about an aspect of development, which is much more psychophysical, that isn't being taken into account. And just doing exercises on the side is not enough.
Right.
You know, so when I was in grad school and I was, you know, doing my dissertation on, you know, touched on education, a couple of people said, well, would you like to introduce this in a classroom? You know, I say, yes, this interests me. And I actually worked in a classroom to introduce this to these ideas in the classroom with, I worked mainly with like 5-year-olds. But when they said, yeah, okay, well, we have an hour with the kids where they do, we put on music and they run around. Would you like to work with them then? I said, no, I would not like to work with them then because that's not what I'm speaking about.
Right.
What I'm speaking about is just as applicable to when they're sitting with a pen or when they're listening to someone read as it is to running around in the room.
Right.
So you're speaking about an aspect of development that is really not just about motor function, but about behavior. And it applies very broadly to everything they do. And in my view, it begins to give a framework for healthy development in the child that applies very broadly to education. So it begins to have a very, you can see it as a foundation, a very broad foundation for development that I think has been left out.
Okay.
Again, there's more to say about it. And, you know, we don't even have to cover it all today, but it just, to me, it you know, when you think about the other areas we mentioned, like cognition or emotional development, I don't think that they give you a very broad, holistic concept of development. They're important. I mean, I'm not saying they're not important, but they don't give you that foundation for, you know, kind of what for what it means for a child to develop in a holistically, healthy way.
Right. Well, I know something that like a story that you often tell, and this, you know, this sort of makes me think of this, you know, just sort of getting into, what sort of a foundation are you envisioning here? It's the story that you tell is about a friend of the family. There were two children. The one was about 7 and the one was about 4?
Yeah, the two brothers. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Two of the brothers. Well, you know, one was a little bit older, maybe 2-3 years older.
Yeah.
And the 4-year-old, you know, hadn't been in school yet. And was a typical 4-year-old running, like a 4-year-old boy running around bonkers off the walls and bright eyed and bushy tailed. And the 7-year-old was not quite like that. But it hadn't always been so. And you ask the mother, do you notice any difference in him now than a couple of years ago? And she said, yeah, like he used to be a lot more like this. And now he's a little bit like, you know, he's sitting in a chair and he's a little bit, I don't know, you know, her word perhaps was like preoccupied. And spaced out a little bit. And it just wasn't always like that. And, you know, you worked with the with the older son a little bit, and it might from the outside be like you're just working with his posture, but you know, the kid was in the chair and you got his sort of back working, as we say, you know, the lingo, you got him sort of going up, as we say, and his eyes brightened and he said, oh, my back doesn't hurt anymore.
Yeah.
And it, like, this is like, this kid, wasn't doing anything that we would normally say is harmful. He's not drinking. You know what I mean? You know, he's not doing, he's a 7-year-old kid. But he's in school and his everyday school behavior is somehow leading to this, you know? And it's like, I don't think we have an adequate, you know, without the sort of subject that you're talking about, we don't really have an adequate explanation for what's happening here.
No.
It just sort of seems to be, oh, he, you know, he's sitting all day and that's bad for him. But what you're saying is much more broad than this. Like it's,
right.
Somehow it, his attention is going away. Somehow his ability to be in the room and to be active has gone away a little bit. And yeah. We don't have an adequate like etiology for this.
Yeah, the whole the tripartite elements you mentioned are all identifiable and they're all problematic.
Yeah, yeah.
And exactly. The school, so I don't blame the school because it's not, if you say, well, kids should be moving more, and you know, that implies that if they moved more and you didn't impose, I mean, I sort of agree with that. He's probably doing too much cognitive stuff too early. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But if you blame that if you attribute the problem to that, then what you're saying is that if he hadn't been forced to sit down so soon and do formal schoolwork, then he would be like the 4-year-old. But the truth is that he won't be like the 4-year-old at 7. Things will go wrong anyway. And
right.
And even if they don't go wrong, it still begs the question, what is it that you don't want to go wrong?
So exactly.
That's just reverting to a romantic conception that somehow if you don't interfere with kids, they're going to be happier. That's sort of nonsense.
Right, right.
So the deeper question is, what is it that we're looking at here that's a problem? One element is that his postural system has been interfered with.
Mm-hmm.
That may not seem like a big deal, but when he's 35, it's going to be a very big deal because he's mm-hmm. going to have his entire motor system is going to be compromised.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, his motor activities are fundamentally misdirected
mm-hmm.
and need to be more, he needs to become more conscious of that. And thirdly, his attention level has already become quite interfered with because he's already preoccupied and inattentive and is losing something that his 4-year-old brother had more of. What is that? The ability to be broadly attentive and aware and alert. That should be something that we get more of as we get older, not less.
Yeah.
Certainly,
yeah.
We should have that same quality of as a 4-year-old, but at a more conscious level. So everything was going wrong and we don't have a concept of that. So that's what you know, the parents knew that because she said, yeah, whatever my younger son has, he doesn't have it anymore, this older one. Mm-hmm. And she said, so he's lost something. And as a mom, she knew, really intuitively was very clear on that.
Right.
And she said, and he's sort of not happy. And he obviously had this developing back problem that he wasn't even aware of.
As a 7-year-old.
And then while he's sitting there, he went back into a slump, spaced out. And I said to her, did you notice, forget the slump, that's obvious, but did you notice what happened to his eyes? She said, yeah, he kind of like turned inward or spaced out. I said, well,
yeah,
that shouldn't happen.
Right.
So all of that is, all those elements are part of what a healthy developing child should not lose.
Right.
And constitute a broader concept of health, because we're talking about muscle tone, we're talking about balanced activity, we're talking about the ability to learn and control and manage yourself in a more conscious way. We're talking about attention level. So we're talking about elements of health that go way beyond posture and physicality.
Right, right. Yeah, that's very interesting. And it's explanatory. You know, you can actually look at a kid. You were able to look at a kid and diagnose a couple of things.
Yeah.
Like we've been saying, you know, like the 3-part thing. It's like,
yeah.
you know, you were first of all able to notice this kid is not broadly attentive in the way that, say, a younger child or your average animal is, you know. And that's a big thing. And then he's sort of slumping in a chair, which the four-year-old wouldn't. It's a very interesting thing to point out to someone. You know, the three-year-old, the four-year-old, you notice they have like ramrod straight posture, you know, and it's like, it strikes me now, having studied with you for so long, it strikes me now how unusual it is that we don't notice that, you know, and like, right. You know, we don't inquire more like, wow, that's really interesting that a 3 and 4 year old is the most charismatic thing in the room, like you say. And part of it is the fact that they've got this effortless ramrod straight posture that they don't seem to be expending any energy to maintain. And it's like, okay, well, the broadly aware and the postural mechanism doesn't seem to be working in the 7-year-old. And when you got him out of that, he sort of came out, his attention improves, his quote unquote posture improves, and then he reverts back. So that's the third, you know, that's the second part. It's like, wow, he just did something. What was that? And so this is very explanatory. You can look at someone and say, look at this, look at what's happening.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the reasons I think why we don't appreciate it is because of our, I mean, this is sort of a flip side of the thing, is our prejudices about mind and body. So, you know, here we're speaking about something that's psychophysical. And you could say, well, this is just as much about attention level and action and misdirected action as it is about posture or the body per se.
Mm-hmm.
But, and people say, yeah, I believe you, and you want to use the term psychophysical and you refuse to call it just physical. But the truth is that they're not going to really appreciate what you mean by that, because mm-hmm. when it comes down to it, you're talking about something physical.
Yeah.
Now, the truth is that if you're learning to become more aware of your posture, even just that, there's nothing about it that's just physical. It's just as much about being attentive as meditation is. But we don't believe that, because once you speak about the body, our prejudices are such that we're going to treat this as something that we relegate to a lesser sphere.
Yeah.
And that's what's happened with this field. So when Alexander developed this theory, he had a huge supporter in John Dewey, who was like the preeminent, you know, early childhood, you know, theorist in education.
Mm-hmm.
And Dewey wrote about it, spoke about it, but was ignored because people fundamentally didn't care. That's a shame. But I think that prejudice about things being physical and therefore not being psychophysical or mental, I think it runs so deep in our culture that it's really hard to appreciate
what the
real significance of this subject is.
Yeah, I mean, you lay it out so clearly, and I still find it elusive. You know, you lay out what you're seeing in a child, sort of what these, you know, for the purposes of this talk, these three aspects of motor development. And yet, like, it's elusive to me. How do we, I don't know, like, how do we include this in a classroom? Like, how do we get this wrapped into childhood education? You know, this is not postural work. It's not working on their attention. It's not working on how well they hold a pen. You know, those are simplifications of the three. And yet, like, how do we, I don't know, what would it look like? Like what would a more enlightened maybe classroom look like?
Yeah. Well, as you know, when I was teaching at Teachers College at Columbia, I had a doctoral student, Tara Fenimore, who is now running her own early childhood program on the West Coast.
Yep.
Now, she runs the whole program, so she's not able to focus on this you know, specifically on this, but she has ideas on this, and we've spoken about it a lot. And I've worked on, you know, particularly early in my, when I was in grad school, I also thought a lot about how this kind of, these issues could be integrated into the classroom. That has to be looked at. And I think the school has to support it, and we have to have an understanding of it as a field. So, I mean, I just want to mention that because, you know, when we, I don't know, speak about other aspects of learning, let's say learning a musical instrument or learning, you know, math, we have how we have the pedagogy and theory of how we teach it, but we also have a larger pedagogy and theory, with a larger sort of a larger understanding of the field that it represents, or that the subject, the teaching in the classroom represents. So
yeah,
we need that. So for instance, if you have, well, here's an aspect of psychophysical development that I think is really terribly ignored, is vocal function. I've worked with 5-year-old children who I think are going to be basically, you know, unable to speak normally by the time they're 20.
Mm-hmm.
No one cared. No one looked at it. No one thought about it. If it went to the doctors would say, oh, well, maybe your child is a little bit husky in his voice, you know. They don't have a concept of normal vocal function. So we're not just speaking about how the child has to be, you know, how we might help that child with vocal function, but we're also speaking about understanding a vocal function as a subject that would back up how the teacher addresses it.
Yeah. Yeah. Taking it out of the realm of like, I don't know how, even how to say it, puritanicalism or like morality, like, oh, you know, the kid needs to work on his voice or needs to speak better or something, to actual vocal function. Like
right.
What is this mechanism? How does it work?
Right. But I'm saying even the people who know about this subject, it's too limited. You know, when I was training, everyone said, well, you got to get Alexander teachers in the classroom. I was like, no, that's not enough.
Yeah.
The Alexander teachers, if they're going to be in the classroom, if they're going to work with a kid's voice, have they studied the voice? No, they need to, you know, you have to have knowledge. So it's understood, you know, that if you're going to work with, I don't know, this is what I meant about yoga. If you're going to teach 3-year-olds about, I don't know, stretching. Mm-hmm. Well, you better understand something about 3-year-olds and how they function at 3 years old. Mm-hmm. You can't just go to a yoga training and think that you're going to be competent to work with 3-year-olds.
Yeah,
you have to have knowledge of development, and you have to have knowledge of that aspect of development. So that has to support what's done in the classroom.
Right.
And we don't have that.
Yeah.
So anyway, how it's taught, that's something that has to be explored further.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think that's an important thing. You know, there's no, you know, it's crucial and it's important, but it's not something that you can just come up with an answer on the spot. Like, how do we get this subject into the classroom? Well, how did we get mathematics into the classroom? It took 2,000 years, you know? Like, we've got not only mathematics, we've got philosophy of mathematics, we've got philosophy of education, we've got a lot behind it.
Yeah.
You know, and there's not so much behind this. You know, not so much time behind this.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And there, you know, I think we could do a follow-up of this if you want, James. And we could talk about that because there's more to say about the curriculum part. You know, how do you develop a curriculum? What would that look like? I'm not a big fan of the idea that you should have someone who's in the classroom who, works with kids individually. I don't think it's that simple.
Mm-hmm.
But how you develop that is interesting. And also how it applies to concepts of development long term.
Yeah.
As I mentioned to you, I think we have... in some ways, remarkably broad ideas about education that in standard public schools around the world. And we have Montessori and Steiner, you know, the Waldorf schools come to mind also as having quite broad ideas. But I don't, I still don't think we have a very unified concept of child development. And I think that this goes toward that idea of what it means for an approach to education to be unified, to be, I don't know how to put it, kind of integrative, so that it has a, we have a concept of child development that really does justice to the full potential of the human being. I don't think we have that yet.
Right, right.
And we could talk about that, because that's sort of a topic in itself, but.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's a huge topic. And, you know, you mentioned curriculum. That's, you know, it's something that we've spoken about a couple of times on this podcast. And, you know, having a broad curriculum that is based solidly on the foundation of what this subject really is. And then it's molded to, you know, not just to different people, but to different age groups and different situations. So that's something really interesting to talk about. But yeah, I think that there's a lot to be said. You know, some of this talk was about what it's not. Some of it is about what it is. And yeah, you know, I would love us to get more into what it is, you know, and what you've thought about this next time.
Okay.
You know?
Sounds good.
Good, great.
Good follow-up. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So thank you, Ted.
Thank you, James.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. Again, this has been The Awareness Connection. We'll talk to you next time. All right.
Thanks bye-bye. For joining all. Okay.